Audiobook in MP3 of Passport to Magonia, Ochiksvaili. If wanting to follow the text read here, search up the online PDF book of this. Chapter 1, Visions of a Parallel World. On June 15, 1952, in the jungles of Yucatan, an archaeological expedition led by Alberto Luis Liliker and three companions made a remarkable discovery. The team was investigating the impressive Palenque monuments, located in the state of Chiapas, on the site of a well-known Mayan city that scientists were busy restoring and mapping in systematic fashion. Yucatan is a region of constant humidity and high temperature, and the tropical vegetation had caused considerable damage to the temples and pyramids erected by the Mayas, whose civilization was marked by the genius of its architects and is thought to have declined in the first centuries of our era, disappearing almost completely about the 9th century, that is, at the time of the Charlemagne Empire in Europe. One of the most impressive constructions on the Palenque site is the Pyramid of Inscriptions, an enormous truncated pyramid with a long stairway in front. The pyramid is of a somewhat unusual design, for on the top is a large temple. The purpose of the monument was unknown until Lilia and his companions suggested that it might have been built as a tomb for some exceptional king, or illustrious priest. Led by this idea, they began to search the temple at the top of the pyramid for some passage or stairway, leading directly into the monument. And on June 15, 1952, they discovered a long flight of stairs going down through the enormous mass and actually underground level. The passage was built after the traditional Mayan fashion, the inclined walls giving the enclosure a high, conical shape ending with a narrow ceiling. Some Indian huts in Yucatan are still built this way, a most efficient design in the tropical climate since it allows hot air to rise, thereby providing a relatively comfortable temperature inside the hut. At the bottom of the temple passage stairway was a splendid crypt, and in the crypt was a sarcophagus covered with a single carved stone measuring 12 feet by 7.10 inches thick. The slab weighed about 6 tons. The fantastic scene depicted by the artists had not suffered. It came to light in every detail, and archaeologists are completely at a loss to interpret its meaning. The Mayans are supposed to have vanished without having invented even the rudiments of a technology. Some archaeologists doubt that they knew the wheel, and yet the design on the Palenque sarcophagus appears to show a very complex and sophisticated device, with a man at the controls of an intricate piece of machinery. Noting that the man is depicted with his knees brought up toward his chest and his back to a complicated mechanism, from which flames are seen to flow, several people, among them Soviet science writer Alexander Kazantsev, have speculated that the Mayans had actually been in contact with visitors from a superior civilization, visitors who used spaceships. Kazantsev's interpretation is difficult to prove. However, the only object we know today closely resembling the Mayan design is the space capsule. The demigod for whom sarcophagus, crypt, and pyramid were built with such splendid craftsmanship by the Mayan artists is something of a puzzle, too. The body is radically different from the morphology of the Mayans, as we imagine them. The corpse is that of a man nearly 6 feet tall, about 8 inches taller than the average Mayan. According to Pierre-Honoré Comer-1, the sarcophagus was made for the great white god, Kukulcan, but no final clue to the mystery has yet been found, and the tropical jungles of Central America where dozens of temples and pyramids are still buried under the exuberant vegetation have not yet yielded the secret of the Palenque sarcophagus. It is in the literature of religion that flying objects from celestial countries are most commonly encountered, along with descriptions of the organization, nature, and philosophy of their occupants. Indeed, several writers have consistently pointed out that the fundamental texts of every religion refer to the contact of the human community with a superior race of beings from the sky. This terminology is used, in particular, in the Bible, where it is said, "They come from a far country, from the end of heaven, even the Lord, and the weapons of his indignation, to destroy the whole land." 2. The visitors have the power to fly through the air using luminous craft, sometimes called celestial chariots. With these manifestations are associated impressive physical and meteorological displays, which the primitive authors call whirlwind, pillar of fire, etc. The occupants of these craft, to whom popular imagery will later ascribe wings and luminosity, are similar to man and communicate with him. They are organized under a strict military system. The chariots of God are 20,000, even thousands of angels. The Lord is among them. Gustave Dore, the French artist who has illustrated splendid editions of the Bible, has left a beautiful engraving showing these celestial chariots in the full power of their fantastic flight, speeding above the mountains, the clouds, and the abyss. A period of the early history of Japan ending about 3000 BC has received the name Jomon Era. During that period, an important artistic activity was the making of earthen statues. For at first, these statues were very simple. Small in size, they were made to represent human beings. But in the middle of the period, the artists started to make larger statues showing standard features of a drastically different design: large chests, arc-shaped legs, very short arms, and large heads obviously covered with complete helmets. On the nature of the helmets, archaeologists disagree. In 1924, because he thought that its expression looked like that found on a wooden mask made in Africa, Dr. Gento Hasebe proposed that the headgear was in reality a mourning mask used at burials. In the Tohoku area of northern Japan, however, some of the most elaborate statues of this kind show something like a pair of sunglasses, huge eyes with an insect-like horizontal slit, a truly remarkable design. Supposedly, the statues of the later part of the Jomon era were first made with earth, then copied on rock or soft stone. Those found in Komukai, Nambu province, are carved in rock and show helmets. One of them, a Jomon dog dated 4300 BC and excavated at the Imadaki ruins in the Iwatk prefecture, shows details of the front part of the helmet, with a round opening at the base of the nose, below what appears to be a large perforated plate. The resemblance of the dog a costume to a pressure suit of the type used by divers and astronauts is the relevant factor here. It has led some students of the Jomon era to speculate that the statues might indicate the distant memory of visitors from space. The headgear with its filter, the large goggles, the necks with wide collars, and the one-piece suits certainly bear a close resemblance to modern space gear. The fact that the sculptors made these figurines hollow is another puzzling element. Altogether, the Far East is a rich source of reports of supernatural beings and celestial signs, as we shall now seconds. Sorcerers from the clouds. It is common belief that the term flying saucer was made in America. Was it not coined by an American businessman in 1947? Was not the first official investigation of the mystery by military authorities started in the United States a few weeks later? Well, yes. But a farmer from Texas described a dark flying object as a large saucer as early as January 1878, 5, and ancient Japanese records inform us that on October 27, 1180, an unusual luminous object described as an earthenware vessel flew from a mountain in the Kii province beyond the northeast mountain of Fukuhara at midnight. After a while, the object changed its course and was lost to sight at the southern horizon, leaving a luminous trail. In view of the time which has elapsed since the sighting, as U.S. Air Force investigators like to say, it would be difficult to obtain additional data today. It is interesting, however, to find a medieval Japanese chronicler speaking of flying earthenware. The Japanese must also receive credit for having organized the first official investigation, and the story is so amusing, and parallels so well recent activities of the U.S. Air Force that I cannot resist reproducing it here. The date was September 24, 1235, 7 centuries before our time, and General Yon Tsum was camping with his army. Suddenly, a curious phenomenon was observed. Mysterious sources of light were seen to swing and circle in the southwest, moving in loops until the early morning. General Yorit Sum ordered what we would now term a full-scale scientific investigation, and his consultants set to work. Fairly soon they made their report. The whole thing is completely natural, general, they said in substance. It is only the wind making the stars sway. My source of information for this report, Yuzuke J. Matsumura, of Yokohama, adds, sadly, scholars on government pay have always made ambiguous statements like this. Celestial phenomena seem to have been so commonplace in the Japanese skies during the Middle Ages that they influenced human events in a direct way. Panics, riots and disruptive social movements were often linked to celestial apparitions. The Japanese peasants had the disagreeable tendency to interpret the signs from heaven as strong indications that their revolts and demands against the feudal system or against foreign invaders were just, and as assurance that their rebellions would be crowned with success. Numerous examples of such situations can be quoted. For instance, on September 12, 1271, the famous priest Nichiren was about to be beheaded at Tatsunokyuchi, Kamakura, when there appeared in the sky an object like a full moon, shiny and bright. Needless to say, the officials panicked and the execution was not carried out. On August 3, 989, during a period of great social unrest, three round objects of unusual brilliance were observed. Later they joined together. In 1361, a flying object described as being shaped like a drum, about 20 feet in diameter, emerged from the inland sea off western Japan. On January 2, 1458, a bright object resembling the full moon was seen in the sky, and this apparition was followed by curious signs in heaven and earth. People were amazed. 2 months later, on March 17, 1458, five stars appeared, circling the moon. They changed color three times and vanished suddenly. The rulers were utterly distressed and believed that the sign announced a great disturbance throughout the land. All the people in Kyoto were expecting disasters to follow, and the emperor himself was very upset. 10 years later, on March 8, 1468, a dark object, which made a sound like a wheel, flew from Mount Kasuga toward the west at midnight. The combination of the sound and the darkness of the flying object is difficult to explain in natural terms. On January 3, 1569, in the evening, a flaming star appeared in the sky. It was regarded as an omen of serious changes, announcing the fall of the Chu dynasty. Such phenomena continued during the 17th and 18th centuries. For instance, in May 1606, fireballs were continuously reported over Kyoto, and one night a whirling ball of fire resembling a red wheel hovered near the Nijo castle and was observed by many of the samurai. The next morning the city was filled with rumors and the people muttered, "This must be a portent." One noon in September, 1702, the sun took on a bloody color several days in succession and cotton-like threads fell down, apparently falling from the sun itself. Phenomena reminiscent of the 1917 observations in Fatima, Portugal. Chaos spread all over Japan on January 2, 1749, when three round objects like the moon appeared and were seen for 4 days. Such a state of social unrest developed, and seemed so clearly linked with the mysterious celestial objects, that the government decided to act. Riot participants were executed. But confusion became total when people observed three moons aligned in the sky and, several days later, two suns. Undoubtedly the Japanese experienced natural phenomena. Similar to mirages and incorrectly interpreted them in the context of social rebellion. From this distance, however, it is impossible to separate the reliable observations from the emotional interpretation. What matters here is the link between certain unusual phenomena, observed or imagined, and the alteration of the witness's behavior. In other words, these accounts show that it is possible to affect the lives of many people by showing them displays that arc beyond their comprehension, or by convincing them that they have observed such phenomena, or by keeping alive the belief that their destiny is somehow controlled by occult forces. A brief examination of legendary elements in Western Europe in the Middle Ages will show that a similar rumor about strange flying objects and supernatural manifestations was spreading there, too. Indeed, Pierre Boaistuau, in 1575, remarked, "The face of heaven has been so often disfigured by bearded, hairy comets, torches, flames, columns, spears, shields, dragons, duplicate moons, suns, and other similar things, that if one wanted to tell in an orderly fashion those that have happened since the birth of Jesus Christ only, and inquire about the causes of their origin, the lifetime of a single man would not be enough." 7. According to the 1594 edition of the same book, this is what happened a few miles from Tübingen, Germany, on December 5, 1577, at 7 a.m. About the sun many dark clouds appeared, such as we are wont to see during great storms, and soon afterward have come from the sun other clouds, all fiery and bloody, and others, yellow as saffron. Out of these clouds have come forth reverberations resembling large, tall and wide hats, and the earth showed itself yellow and bloody, and seemed to be covered with hats, tall and wide, which appeared in various colors such as red, blue, green, and most of them black. It is easy for everyone to think of the meaning of this miracle, which is that God wants to induce men to amend their lives and make penance. May Almighty God inspire all men to recognize Him. Amen. Especially interesting to us will be the fact that these reports of celestial objects are linked with claims of contact with strange creatures, a situation parallel to that of modern-day UFO landings. Passport to Magonia. Since these rumors have been puzzling to many authorities in the Roman Catholic Church, perhaps it is appropriate to begin with a quotation from the life of Saint Anthony, the Egyptian-born founder of Christian monasticism who lived about 300 AD in the desert. St. Anthony met with a strange being of small stature, who fled after a brief conversation with him. Before long, in a small rocky valley shut in on all sides, he sees a mannikin with hooted snout, horned forehead, and extremities like goat's feet. When he saw this, Anthony, like a good soldier, seized the shield of faith and the helmet of hope. The creature nonetheless began to offer him the fruit of the palm tree to support him on his journey and, as it were, pledges of peace. Anthony, perceiving this, stopped and asked who he was. The answer he received from him was this: "I am a mortal being and one of the inhabitants of the desert whom the Gentiles deluded by various forms of error worship under the names of fauns, satyrs and incubi. I am sent to represent my tribe. We pray you in our behalf to entreat the favor of your Lord, and ours, who, we have learned, came once to save the world, and whose sound has gone forth into all the earth." As he uttered such words as these, the aged traveler's cheeks streamed with tears. The marks of his deep feeling, which he shed in the fullness of his joy, he rejoiced over the glory of Christ and the destruction of Satan, and marveling all the while that he could understand the satyr's language, and striking the ground with his star, he said, "Woe to thee, Alexandria, who instead of God worshippest monsters! Woe to thee, harlot city, into which have flowed together the demons of the whole world! What will you say now? Beasts speak of Christ, and you instead of God worship monsters." He had not finished speaking when, as if on wings, the wild creature fled away. Let no one scruple to believe this incident. Its truth is supported by what took place when Constantine was on the throne, a matter of which the whole world was witness. For a man of that kind was brought alive to Alexandria and shown as a wonderful sight to the people. Afterwards his lifeless body, to prevent its decay through the summer heat, was preserved in salt and brought to Antioch that the emperor might see it. Again, with this story, we are faced with an account the truthfulness of which it would be futile to question. The lives of the early saints are full of amazing miracles that should be taken as literary figures rather than as scientific observations. The important point is that basic religious texts contain such material, giving, so to speak, letters of nobility to a category of beings widely believed to be of supernatural origin. Such observations as St. Anthony's will prove fundamental when religious authorities are faced with the problem of evaluating medieval observations of beings from the sky, claims of evocation of demons by occult means, and even modern miracles. The details and the terminology of such observations as Street Anthony's are not important to this study. It is enough to note that in St. Anthony's account the strange being is indifferently termed a satyr and a mannequin, while the saint himself states that the Gentiles also use the names Faun and Incubus. St. Jerome speaks of a man of that kind. Throughout our study of these legends, we shall find the same confusion. In the above account, however, it is at least clear to St. Anthony that the creature is neither an angel nor a demon. If it had been, he would have recognized it immediately. In the 20th-century-old Indian book of primitive astronomy, Surya Siddhanta, it is said that below the moon and above the clouds revolve the Siddhas, perfected men, and the Vidyaharas, possessors of knowledge. According to Andrew Thomas, Indian tradition holds that the Siddhas could become very heavy at will or as light as a feather, travel through space and disappear from sight. Observations of beings who flew across the sky and landed are also found in the writings of Agobard, Archbishop of Lyon, France. Agobard, who was born in Spain in 779 and came to France when 3 years old, became Archbishop at 37. When he died in 840, one of the most celebrated and learned prelates of the 9th century, he left an interesting account of a peculiarly significant incident. We have, however, seen and heard many men plunged in such great stupidity, sunk in such depths of folly, as to believe that there is a certain region, which they call Magonia, whence ships sail in the clouds, in order to carry back to that region those fruits of the Kartli which are destroyed by hail and tempests, the sailors paying rewards to the storm wizards and themselves receiving corn and other produce. Out of the number of those whose blind folly was deep enough to allow them to believe these things possible, I saw several exhibiting in a certain concourse of people, 4 persons in bonds, 3 men and a woman who they said had fallen from these same ships. After keeping them for some days in captivity, they had brought them before the assembled multitude, as we have said, in our presence to be stoned. But truth prevailed. 11. We shall see in the following pages that the occultists give a quite different interpretation to the same incident. The 7 visitors of Fascius Cardan. Throughout medieval times, a major current of thought distinct from official religion existed, culminating in the works of the alchemists and hermetics. Among such groups were to be found some of the early modern scientists and men remarkable for the strength of their independent thinking and for their adventurous life, such as Paracelsus. The nature of the beings who mysteriously appeared, dressed in shiny garments or covered with dark hair, and with whom communication was so hard to establish, intrigued these men intensely. They were the first to relate these strange beings to the creatures described in the Bible and in the writings of the early Kabbalists. According to biblical writers, the heavenly hierarchy includes beings of human form called cherubim, a name that in Hebrew means full of knowledge. Ezekiel describes them in the following terms: their appearance was like burning coals of fire, and like the appearance of lamps, it went up and down among the living creatures, and the fire was bright, and out of the fire went forth lightning. 12 are the mysterious creatures who fly through the sky and land in their cloud ships, Agobard's authority notwithstanding, of the same race as the angels? Asked the old philosophers. No, because they are mortal. The Hebrews used to call these beings who are between the angels and man Sadaim, and the Greeks, transposing the letters and adding but one syllable, called them daimonas. Among their ancient philosophers, these demons were held to be an aerial race, ruling over the elements, mortal, engendering, and unknown in this century to those who rarely seek truth in her ancient dwelling place, which is to say, in the Kabbalah and in the theology of the Hebrews, who possessed the special art of holding communion with that aerial people and of conversing with all these inhabitants of the air. 13 Plutarch even had a complete theory on the nature of these beings. He thinks it absurd that there should be no mean between the two extremes of an immortal and a mortal being, that there cannot be in nature so vast a flaw, without some intermedial kind of life, partaking of them both. As, therefore, we find the intercourse between the soul and the body to be made by the animal spirits, So between divinity and humanity there is this species of demons. 14 It is not surprising, then, to find that the philosophers disagreed with Agobard on the nature of the three men and the woman who were captured by the mob in Leon. In vain does a philosopher bring to light the falsity of the Chimera's people have fabricated, and present manifest proofs to the contrary. No matter what his experience, nor how sound his argument and reasoning, let but a man with a doctor's hood come along and write them down as false, experience and demonstration count for naught, and it is henceforward beyond the power of truth to re-establish her empire. People would rather believe in a doctor's hood than in their own eyes. There has been in your native France a memorable proof of this popular mania. The famous Kabbalist Caius, in the reign of your Pepin, took it into his head to convince the world that the elements are inhabited by those peoples whose nature I have just described to you. The expedient of which he bethought himself was to advise the sylphs to show themselves in the air to everybody. They did so sumptuously. Lies beings were seen in the air in human form, sometimes in battle array marching in good order, halting under arms, or encamped beneath magnificent tents. Sometimes on wonderfully constructed aerial ships, whose flying squadrons roved at the will of the zephyrs. What happened? Do you suppose that ignorant age would so much as reason as to the nature of these marvelous spectacles? The people straightway believed that sorcerers had taken possession of the air for the purpose of raising tempests and bringing hail upon their crops. The learned theologians and jurists were soon of the same opinion as the masses. The emperor believed it as well, and this ridiculous chimera went so far that the wise Charlemagne, and after him Louis the Debonair, imposed grievous penalties upon all these supposed tyrants of the air. You may see an account of this in the first chapter of the capitularies of these two emperors. The sylphs, seeing the populace, the pedants and even the crowned heads thus alarmed against them, determined to dissipate the bad opinion people had of their innocent fleet by carrying off men from every locality and showing them their beautiful women, their republic and their manner of government, and then setting them down again on earth in divers parts of the world. They carried out their plan. The people who saw these men as they were descending came running from every direction, convinced beforehand that they were sorcerers who had separated from their companions in order to come and scatter poisons on the fruit and in the springs. Carried away by the frenzy with which such fancies inspired them, they hurried these innocents off to the torture. The great number of them who were put to death by fire and water throughout the kingdom is incredible. One day, among other instances, it chanced at Leon that three men and a woman were seen descending from these aerial ships. The entire city gathered about them, crying out they were magicians and were sent by Grimaldus, Duke of Conventum, Charlemagne's enemy, to destroy the French harvests. In vain the four innocents sought to vindicate themselves by saying that they were their own country folk, and had been carried away a short time since by miraculous men who had shown them unheard of marvels, and had desired to give them an account of what they had seen. The frenzied populace paid no heed to their defense, and were on the point of casting them into the fire, when the worthy Agobard, Bishop of Leon, who having been a monk in that city had acquired considerable authority there, came running at the noise, and having heard the accusations of the people and the defense of the accused, gravely pronounced that both one and the other were false. That it was not true that these men had fallen from the sky, and that what they said they had seen there was impossible. The people believed what their good father Agobard said rather than their own eyes, were pacified, set at liberty the four ambassadors of the sylphs, and received with wonder the book which Agobard wrote to confirm the judgment which he had pronounced. Thus the testimony of these four witnesses was rendered vain. Such stories were so well established during the Middle Ages that the problem of communicating with the elementals became a major preoccupation of the Hermetics and an important part of their philosophy. Paracelsus wrote an entire book on the nature of these beings, but betook great pains to warn the reader of the dangers of an association with them. I do not want to say here, because of the ills which might befall those who would try it, through which compact one associates with these beings, thanks to which compact they appear to us and speak to us, and in a treatise entitled Why These Beings Appear to Us, Lai presented the following ingenious theory: everything God creates manifests itself to man sooner or later.